I get huge enjoyment out of it because you're learning every day. You're getting kicked down every day. You're getting setbacks every day. And it's not just managing something. It's about creating something that doesn't exist yet and creating a market.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the brand new series of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This is season 8. That is absolutely mind-blowing, and I'm extremely proud of a couple of things. I'm very proud of having reached 8 seasons of this, to be bringing this to you every single week. And I'm also very proud for an announcement I've got to share with you today. If you've listened to Monday's episode, you already know what I'm about to say, so spoiler alert. But if not, and if you listen, if you watch and follow me on social media, if not, get on it right now. It's Mr. Gary Fox on all social platforms. You will know I've been hinting at a big announcement to make, which I'm going to make right now. We have a brand new partner, and we have a brand new partner, not just for this season, but for the entire year. And not just any kind of partner. We have a global leader partnering with us. And this tells a lot about where the podcast has grown to today, that we have a company of this stature coming on board. They are the global leader in providing software for HR, payroll, and finance for SMEs, just like you. They're, of course, Sage. It's incredible to be able to announce Sage as my new partner for all of 2022. We're going to be doing some exciting things together, so stay tuned for that. If you're watching on YouTube, you can click the first link in the description below to visit Sage. Or if you're listening online, go to the podcast description and you'll be able to follow Sage there, sage.com. Now, on with today's episode, we are chatting to John Phelan, the head of HBAN, which is the Halo Business Angel Network. And he's also the founder of Recommender X. So John is an investor, but he's also an entrepreneur, the best of both worlds, someone with skin in the game. John sees hundreds of startup pitches every single year. He knows what a good one looks like. He knows what a bad one looks like. He knows what key traits successful companies have. John reveals everything in this episode. So if you're a startup founder and you want to know what a good pitch looks like, you want to improve your pitch, this episode is gold. Equally, if you're someone who wants to become an investor or figure out more about that world, he drops all the info about how to get started, how to become an investor, why joining a syndicate might be the key, and how much the average investment is. It's not as much as you think, and it's probably pretty affordable for many of you listening. It's about the size of a reasonably priced car. Now, let's get started with our episode with John Phelan, the head of HBAN and founder of Recommender X. John, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. Love to meet you.
So 2022, we're looking ahead. Going to get spiritual. It's our first time having a real live angel on the pod.
Yeah, I've heard of some bullshit stars, so that's a good one.
It only just came to me, a flash of inspiration. That's the new year. We got to allow ourselves to have a bit of crack.
I was born on Christmas Day, so I've been called everything, Gary.
Ah, look, come on.
Far worse.
It's meant to be. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. You?
Good start to the year. Good start. Look, yeah, we'll crack on. We'll just plow on, head down. We were chatting briefly off air about the second year of this, but look, we're still here. We're still working. We'll get through it. We'll briefly talk about it, look, because we have to address it in some way. What's the last 2 years been like for you?
I suppose there's two different parts of it. If you look at it in two different ways, one is on a work basis, it's actually been really productive in terms of not having to go out and do all the meetings, not have to set up all the events. Mm. I mean, we, in my HBAN hat on, we normally do 60 to 70 events a year, where you have companies coming in and presenting to anywhere between 5 and 40 angels in a room. When you're doing that amount of events, there's a huge amount of time involved in getting those together. But everything's been online, so it's actually made it far more efficient. But what you're missing is that personal interaction. You're missing that personal piece of looking in the whites of the eyes of founders coming in and presenting their case. But actually, a lot of people are sort of saying, yeah, that's part of what we liked to see in the past, not necessarily what we need to see now. I think we'll see that blended version coming through. And then the second part of it is, on a personal basis, I think everybody's just tired of this, right? Mm-hmm. It's quite exhausting sitting on Zoom day in, day out. And I think we all enjoy the energy we get from people, particularly the energy you get from startup companies coming in, or founders coming in, or angels who are getting excited about a company. because you have that bubble of optimism, there are that stage of development, which is that here's all the exciting stuff that we could do. Now it's going to be a pain in the ass getting to there, but we don't know that yet. And I think that kind of relationship piece, I'm really looking forward to getting back to that and keeping the efficiency pieces as well.
That's really interesting you say that, because I was literally just chatting to someone this morning. We've been a members community for the podcast, and at the start we did online everything. We were doing online Friday accountability calls, online monthly masterclasses, online meetings every couple of weeks. And it just, like, the attendance just like went slowly down. And then we did some in-person meetings as soon as kind of COVID eased up. We did in-person meetings and the demand was just like, I can't wait to go and meet people and have a coffee. But I think the blend, I was only asking someone that this morning, I was like, where would you like to be with these events? Like, would you like some online, some offline? And that's where we kind of were settling on that kind of blend of being able to go, maybe not go to every single one, but still be able to go kind of virtually.
Yeah, and if I see what's happened to us when in the HBAN side, when we have the in-person events, we were getting 15, 20 people at the larger events. When we went online, we started getting 50, 60 people. Wow. But it wasn't just from Dublin. We were getting them from all over the country. Mm-hmm. Plus, we were getting them from the States, from the UK, from Japan, from Singapore. They're all just dialing in because they could. And you're sort of going, actually, that's kind of interesting that people are doing that. Say that again, sorry.
The barrier to entry to attending, you know, maybe you're not comfortable, or, you know, that imposter syndrome, because all entrepreneurs and probably investors have that as well. Oh, I'm only a small entrepreneur. I'm only not really an entrepreneur. I'm not really an investor. You probably get that. But if you can kind of dial in, you're in your gym jams at home, it's kind of a bit okay.
A bit anonymous.
Yeah.
You just sit behind whatever name you put up there. No, we do screen everybody coming in. So the companies, we only allow members. Primarily because the companies are presenting quite a lot of quite confidential information and want to know that it's members of HBAN who are there, who have been vetted by us. They've also signed all the confidentiality forms. They've also gone through the process. They've signed up to codes of conduct, and we'd have fairly rigorous reviews of those on a fairly regular basis. So that's the confidence side on both sides of the equation, is that on the one side we have well-filtered companies. So if you think about it, we get 600 to 700 inquiries a year. We only present about 120 to 150 to our network. And that doesn't mean that all the other companies are not good. It just means that they're not a fit for what we do. And I'm at pains to say that to a lot of good companies, is that it's just the sector you're in is just not something that our network understands or appreciates. And that's our problem, not theirs.
So for anyone not familiar with you, what do you guys do? You match companies with investors?
So I suppose if I take it back to first principles, we're a dating agency. That's the easiest way to look at what we do. We have a marriage with a planned divorce is the way I put it.
I like that.
And the marriage piece is bringing high net worths together with good quality deal flow, and you put the two together and that's the marriage piece. But what the investors will always be looking for is the planned divorce, and the planned divorce is their exit. So where do they get the return on investment?
I love that. I'm going to clip that. You'll see me looking down throughout the episode with like going, oh, I'm going to pull that out. That's a great clip. I love that. So a marriage with a planned divorce. So explain briefly for anyone who hasn't heard of kind of angel investing and HBAN, what is it in kind of a nutshell? So you match people, but what is angel investing, I suppose, to start with that?
Angel investing is typically private investors who come from sectors that they understand typically, and they will invest in companies that they see opportunities in for future growth. Now, if I look at the history of what we did in HBAN, and HBAN is a network of individuals, and we have 17 syndicates on the island, but we also have 4 syndicates overseas. So we have syndicates in New York, London, Singapore, and Dubai. And 10 years ago, what we said, we had individuals who came in and said, right, I've got, say, 100,000 to invest. And we had companies coming in. And we found it difficult to get 3 companies that really deserved to get money invested in them on one side of the table. But on the other side of the table, we struggled to get 3 real investors who really were going to invest in companies, because it was such a new asset class that nobody really knew what it was or how it worked or anything like that. How it's evolved over the years is that we had the individuals first, then we have started syndicates, and we have a number of really strong syndicates in the MedTech group out in Galway. We have Iris, and we have the Bloom and Build syndicates in Dublin and Cork.
What's a syndicate, John?
Let me take it back to first principles again. So a syndicate is a group of individuals who come together and form a group. So they syndicate their money together. So say, for example, in MedTech, you would have 50 people who would be coming together once quarterly to review anywhere between 3 and 5 companies. They would decide if they're going to invest in any of those companies. In any one year, they would do anywhere between 3 and 7 deals. But because 10 years ago, you would have seen people coming in saying, I've got 250 grand and I want to put it on black, which is one company, one statistically a poor investment because you're going into a high-risk company with only one amount of money. What we saw in the last 5 years is people saying, I've got 250,000. I'm going to put it on 10 companies at 25K each. Mm. And that statistically spreads my risk. But if I do it within a syndicate and I've got, say, 40 other people or 50 people in the syndicate, somebody in that syndicate will understand the opportunity that's been presented by the company and the founders, and they will have the ability to understand better than I will whether the proposition technically and commercially has a real opportunity to deliver. So whereas I might like the founders and I like what they're saying, and I'm willing to put in my 20 to 25K, I don't understand it enough to say, to be confident that I'll make a return out of this. But if this person over here who comes from that sector is saying that this is a big problem and these guys have a solution to solve it, and there's 10 other people in the room are saying, yeah, listen, we'll all go in for 25K each. And actually the company still gets 250 grand, but it gets it from 10 individuals who have de-risked their own investment, and they have somebody who comes from the sector who has the ability to make it really happen. So that's the joy of a syndicate.
I love that. Yeah, it really makes sense as well.
Take it back from the individuals grew to syndicates. Syndicates got very strong, very powerful, because people could see that network effect of how they were going to increase their own knowledge, but also they're going to de-risk what their investment was going to be, and they were going to increase their potential to get a good return. Then what we started seeing was that we had the syndicates around the country. They started investing with each other. So now we have individuals, then syndicates, and now we have syndicates investing with syndicates. And we're seeing quite a lot of that going on at the moment. And then what we saw recently is that the international syndicates said, well, actually, if those guys are doing it, we'll do it as well. So now they're jumping in on top of the syndicates as well. So you're getting this real network effect of international syndicates joining existing syndicates who are already syndicating amongst each other. So it's getting very complex, which is good. But we would see anywhere between 300 and 400 individuals investing in any one year.
That's a lot. That is a lot. And how much, it's a very broad question, I guess. Well, it's specific but broad. How much would someone have to have to become an angel investor?
We're having a conference shortly on the 2nd of February. And it's about demystifying angel investing. And the second part of the theme is the growth of impact investing, which are two very big topics for the world we exist in. But the demystifying one is one topic that always needs the bubble burst. Because everybody sort of says, well, to have angel investing, you must have to have millions. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, actually, no. Our median investment last year was 25K per deal. So you're getting into the amounts of capital required is a lot less. And the reason it's a lot less, but the companies benefit because they still get the 250 or the 300, that would be the average that we would do, because they're getting more people involved.
The syndicate then makes sense. That makes really obvious sense, because of everything you've just explained there. The syndicates layering on top of the 25K. So it's quite accessible then. I think a lot of people look at angel investing as exactly what you said, you know, yachts and Ferraris and kind of going, oh yeah, here's 2 million, 3 million. Because that's what you read about, right? You read these crazy valuation deals. Like, we're bombarded with these crazy deals because they're sexy and they make headlines, and Bolt has raised another 600 million. And you kind of get that brainwashing of the Silicon Valley effect. So over here, it's quite different. I guess it's the same in the States. There's this underbelly of angel investors who don't really get that press because they're part of syndicates and part of wider deals.
Yeah, you get the noisy ones, particularly in the US and in the EU. And we do a lot of work with the EBAN, which is the European Business Angel Network, which I sit on the board of. And then we do a lot of work with the ACA, which is the Angel Capital Association in the US. And both of those, you will find, when you pull back the layers of all the big sort of big deals and blah, 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 which is all the news ones, it's actually the average investment in the EU is about 23,000 euros per angel. And the average investment in the US is about $20,000. So you're getting into more accessible amounts of money. And when you get outside the Silicon Valley bubble, and everybody talks about the Silicon Valley ecosystem, it's mental over there. It's great, but it's mental. And you can learn a lot, but if you start believing it all, you're in a really strange place. You're going to be in a really strange place. And when you start meeting the people outside of that bubble, the figures we're talking about here are probably far more normal. I mean, the thing about Silicon Valley is the quantum, the amounts of capital that's available, and the speed they can deploy it is a lot different to anywhere else in the world. So we hear all the big numbers about millions going in, and it went in an hour and a half after I met the founder. That doesn't happen in many other places.
Probably doesn't happen really ever, but it's a good story. We met in the taxi, and then by the restaurant, we'd done the deal. It's a good story. Look, a lot of stuff is founder story, right? The founder myth, the myth of the origin, like we all, you know, what can you say in one sentence that sums it up? How did you get involved in this? Because it seems quite a, I'd say when you got involved, it was quite a mysterious business. So how did you get started in all this?
Probably like most people, by accident. How much time have you got?
I can do the full hour on you. It's fine.
I suppose if I go back to this, to my sort of origin. So my first career is animation and games. So that's where I started. And I worked in a studio here called Sullivan Bluth. Then I went to Warner Brothers in the UK. Worked on Space Jam there, which is...
Oh, wow. What a movie.
Yeah, it's a great one. And what happened there was that after about 16, 17 months, Warner Brothers said, listen, too expensive in London, we're moving to London. And I knew a lot of people out in California, and I just rang up a couple of them and said, listen, is there any contract work going through? So I did a deal for $1 million, and I took about 30 people down the road with me. And I said to Warner, I said, listen, it's going to cost you too much money to take all this equipment back. Why don't you just give it to me? And they said, okay, well, why don't you pay us for it? I said, well, it'll cost you more to take it back than me just taking it off your hands. So why don't I just take it off your hands? And to be fair, they went, yeah, okay.
That's a great deal. How did you even think of that? How did you even kind of go, all right, I'm going to chance this? Like,
well, I had no money, so it's just a case of I need to do this. So just give it if you can.
It's the best negotiating tactic. Well, my budget is zero. So you can take the zero or take the zero.
I've got nothing to lose, right?
Yeah.
And it was a forced entrepreneurism. And I set up a studio with another guy, and we did really well for a number of years, to the extent that I was headhunted to go to run a game studio. And what I could see in the UK was, at the time, it was sterling against everything else, but sterling was getting too strong. So we were really struggling to be competitive against any of the EU markets or even the US markets. And it was tough. And I got this offer to go to a game studio in Chicago. And my view was that, actually, it's very similar to animation. Mm. If I go there and learn what the process is, I can take back and set up a studio in Ireland. And I did this with the full knowledge of the guys in Chicago. But our clients were tier ones. They were Disney, Mattel, TLC. So it's all the big companies. And of course, we went there, got the first couple of games done under budget, on time for their first time ever. So everybody's delighted. And then March 2001 came along, which is the dot bomb and blew the shit out of the whole market. So then I was back looking at, right, I'm in Chicago, got a young family. This is nuts. So I came back to Ireland and went back to college, or went to college for the first time, because I didn't do a primary degree. I went back in and did an MBA. And then I went in and did some corporate financy stuff. And when I came out, I set up another company, which was an indoor golf center. And I suppose what I found there was that I don't like golf. And
at what point did you find that out? That seems like a big problem.
I sort of thought, my logic was, is that I set it up in the IFSC. I did a deal with the developer that I had a 3,000 square foot unit for 100 quid a month.
Oh, wow.
And again, it was making deals along the way. And I said, listen, if we make this work, we'll pay you properly. But for the moment, give this to me for a year. And he did, to be fair to him. And then I did a deal on these video sort of indoor golf simulators. I suppose that was a lesson as well. But the real lesson there was that I didn't have a passion for golf. And my immature thinking was that people in the IFSC all play golf and they want to come down and practice and have fun and everything else. The reality is they don't. They want to get out and play golf outdoors in the fresh air. It doesn't really matter.
To be fair, that idea IFSC, now, you'd be absolutely cleaning up. So timing really is everything. Like, look, we can relaunch it. We can relaunch it.
Yeah, timing is hugely important. And it really is. Timing in parts of venture and in terms of when you bring a company to market, timing is one of the biggest things to consider, because if you're 3 to 5 years ahead of the market, you may not be alive by the time the market realizes that you're the solution to their problem. And I've seen quite a lot of companies do that. I've done that myself.
It's super common, isn't it, though? It's something isn't talked about because it's not controllable. It's not a, you know, timing. It's you can get lucky. You know, you can have a hand sanitizer company 2 years ago and you can be tipping along and now suddenly we're in the money. But like, timing is so key. But I think it's just one of those things, it's not controllable. So often people are like, oh, I'm really early in the market. But there's, like, exactly like you said, you can be 5 years too early or you can be a year too early. You're too early, great, you're a visionary. 5 years too early, you're that guy with the weird idea that people don't like to zip psych, you won't stop talking about it. It's a fine line, isn't it?
It's probably worse than that, Gary, because what you're going to do is run out of money. And it's how do you survive to the point, to that inflection point in the market, when the market actually wants what you have. And you have that pure product market fit where the market is coming to you because of what you have, rather than you trying to push it onto them. So it's a tricky one.
At what point did you realize they wanted to get out golfing and not come to your indoor studio?
Oh, well, I lost my first shirt.
Going through the wardrobe, just picking out shirts to lose.
Shirt. I'm getting out of this. And you know what? I wasn't enjoying it. And it was a case of, right, that's a lesson learned, right? So the first business I set up, I had a huge passion for it and I loved it. This one I didn't. And yeah, that I made a few very wrong decisions. Then I saw an advertisement in the paper, which was for somebody setting up a business angel network with the Dublin Business Innovation Centre. And I went for the job and I didn't get it. And what happened was Dublin Big, there was a great guy called John McInerney, who was on the interview panel, rang me up about 3 months later and said, listen, I love what you were saying. And I wanted you on there. The other two thought you were crap, so you weren't coming on.
I fought for you.
So can you come in and just do some work with us in Dublin Big? And I had no idea what Dublin Big did, but what they do is they do an awful lot of work with early stage founders to get them investor ready.
Okay.
And they put them through a program where they take their business plan to the stage where it is investor ready, because a lot of people, just the natural starting of a business is that you have an idea, but it's how do you get it down into a format that's digestible for other people, but has substance behind it as well, and shares what the opportunity is, but shares it in a way that is credible. And I fell into that with Dublin Bic, and I really loved it and still love it. I still do it with them. And then when the H-Band, because they managed H-Band, that opportunity came about again about 6 months later. And I was asked if I'd go in and help that. And I did. And I've probably been with that ever since. So that's probably the guts of 12, 13 years.
Wow.
But the way we work is that H-Band is, I do part-time and always have. Because outside of that, I still have my own companies, which I think it's really important to be able to empathize with the other founders how tough this is. It's not easy. Mm. It's evolving all the time. But it's a huge amount. I get huge enjoyment out of it because you're learning every day.
Exactly.
You're getting kicked down every day. You're getting setbacks every day. And it's not just managing something. It's about creating something that doesn't exist yet and creating a market. That's hugely exciting. And especially when it starts coming through. So I suppose they're the two parts of what I do.
I love that. I think that is fundamentally key, is people with skin in the game. There's so many people around the, I'm using air quotes if you're listening and not watching on YouTube, startup ecosystem who are professional coaches and professional this and professional that, but equally they've never run a business, or nor do they run a business currently. So I think there's a so much gold from people like yourself who've skin in the game, who either have exited and now are taking some time to do something else, or simultaneously doing it. Like there's no parallel. You can't understand it, right? You can't be told how horrible and hard it is because you won't listen.
I tried to explain to somebody why you started work at 4 a.m. this morning because you had shit to do.
Yeah.
And I was looking at you going, why would you do that?
Yeah, that makes no sense.
Starters.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense, but you can't explain it. So I think that's fundamentally important. So you get the best of both worlds. You get to come in and feel all that energy of all the startups who are at different stages. And then you get to bring that with you into your own business. So talk to me a little bit about that. What are you working on now?
So I co-founded a company a number of years ago called RecommenderX with Kevin McCarthy. And RecommenderX, we started doing services work with MasterCard a number of years ago, and then we decided to productize it, and we started doing some work with Unilever because they said, we've got a massive problem, which is that we have all these data sources. We've got 10 different data sources that need to come in together. Everybody in the organization uses different data sources. They all use the ones that reflects well on them, but doesn't use the real data that shows what's really going on. And can you help give us one view of all of that, one view of the truth? So we developed a proof of concept for that. And this was sponsored by the head of digital in Europe, the head of the UK, head of Ireland, and their innovation group out of Singapore called the Foundry. So we thought, yes, we're sorted here. So we did a proof of concept. We did the first version with them. And the global team came in and said, that's really cool. We're going to do that ourselves. You're out.
Oh.
So they threw us out. And that was painful. And we said, okay, well, listen, let's look at the bright side of this, if there is one. And the bright side to me was very clear. It was that companies like Unilever could build their own version of this. Because they have the cash flows, they have the balance sheets, they have the resources, and they have the time to do it. But there's thousands and thousands of consumer brands and FMCG companies that don't.
Mm.
So they need to buy in a SaaS model, which is just this is what you pay per month, but you get the same feature sets as the likes of Unilever, who've just spent 10 to 20 million to build their own version of it. So we've developed this platform called Advise, which we pushed out. And O'Brien Fine Foods was our first customer. And they've done phenomenally well in the last 2 years using it. And then what ended up happening, then we had a number of other customers here and in the UK as well. And then what happened was Unilever came back to us and said, we can't make this work. So we're now working with Ekaterra, which is the tea division of Unilever, which is the $3 billion a year revenues. Wow. And we're working with them again. We've also got some new clients with a number of other Irish companies, but also in the US, we've got a number of clients. And the US ones is just a different animal altogether. The clients we're dealing with in the Midwest, their main client is Target. And they have 130 vendors like Ekaterra that we are starting to work with now. So that's a huge opportunity. And essentially what we're doing is democratizing the data for consumer brands to work with retailers.
And what sort of data are they getting back then? What are they seeing through this?
So if you take it back to first principles, the pitch is that it's a revenue growth management platform. So what they do is all the data sets that they get in. So they get in the likes of the Nielsen data. They get in the likes of the IRI data. So all the EPOS data, which is the store data, they can bring that and munge that together. But they can munge it together with the likes of Shopper Intelligence or the likes of Kantar data, which is, and then you can bring in financial data. You can bring in margin data. You can bring in price and promotion. So we can do simulations of price and promotion. So if somebody is doing, so say for example, they're doing a tea promotion, they're sort of saying, well, which promotion should I do in the next 6 months?
Oh, wow. Okay.
What we can do is go back and look at the history of not just what they have done, but what all the competition has done. And then you can look at it and say, well, this is the best price point if you're looking for market penetration. But actually, if you're looking for volume sales, then this is the one you need to use, is this here, here, and here. And if you do a 2-for-1, you get an uplift of this. But actually, if you do a third off, you get this. So it'll make it takes in machine learning and does a predictive recommendation of what you should do to get the best result that you want.
I love it.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, it must have been a wild couple of years in the food space and the grocery space.
Well, I'll tell you what, we launched the advice platform on the 1st of March with O'Brien's in 2020. And then on the 13th of March, the whole market just collapsed. So yeah, it was fun.
We're not seeing any data. I think it's broken.
it's a shit show. It was as simple as that, because all our customers in Ireland and the UK were looking at, we don't care about any data. We know we're paying for it. Mm. Our biggest problem is filling the shelves, because everybody's buying it because they're panic buying, and they're panic buying for the next, and they did for the following, whatever, 9 months. And then you had Brexit coming in. So all the UK guys were going, we can't get it. We can't get the supply chain in. That turned, I would say, the summer of last year. And we started seeing a big interest again coming back. So the last 6 months of last year was very good.
Excellent. Excellent. How do you move through industries? That's because you've bridged quite. How do you move through so many industries? So you've had quite a varied career, like most entrepreneurs do, but you've moved industries a number of times. How have you found that transition? And I suppose, how have you brought yourself up to speed in the new industries? Because it's quite a transition from all the industries you've worked in.
Good question. I would say I'm still not up to speed on any of the industries I've ever worked in. I think there's a huge amount of that deep domain knowledge of an industry takes a huge amount of soaking up. And my MO has been find the people who lived in that sector and have that deep domain knowledge that I will never get, and work with them to understand it as best I can to access the market. But say, for example, if you're looking at the consumer goods market, what we found you need is you need reference clients. So you need the likes of Ekaterra, you need the likes of Unilever, you need the likes of O'Brien's or Green Isle or whoever else you have on the board there. And then you need the US ones, and being able to say that you're a target client, that opens up doors. And once you have the doors open, you can get in and share with them all the good stuff that you are doing, but you have the credibility to get in there with them and do it then. So I think there's very much an element of knowing what you don't know and putting your hands up and being able to ask others for help. And I think the community that we work in is generally very good and generally very giving. So I know I ask a lot of people a lot of very stupid questions, and they don't even laugh at me outright. They work with me.
Well, this is the beauty of the pod. That's what I've learned over 2 years, is the ability to ask stupid questions. And generally, I'll preface it with, for anyone that doesn't know, but generally it's me. I don't have a clue what I'm talking about, so I'll just ask because I'm curious. But I think that's it, isn't it? It's just that openness, that curiosity. And you see that with all great entrepreneurs. They're just curious people in general. You meet them and they're curious about everything. They're not just curious about what they're working on. They're just curious people, and they're not afraid to make mistakes and look silly. And that's kind of why I asked you the question about moving industries, because a lot of people are afraid to, they might be miserable in, like, let's say yourself in the golf industry, you probably could have kept that going, making cash probably would have come good. But there's that fear of the unknown. There's that fear. When you see new entrepreneurs coming in, I'm kind of conscious of we get a lot of people listening who are on the cusp. They're right there. They have the idea. And I get this message. This is the most common message I get after certain episodes. Oh, I was listening to John episode, but how do you make the leap? So the most common question is, people are like, I have an idea. How do I make that initial jump off?
Yeah, I suppose the Kool-Aid would be very much, oh, just jump in. And I would be, don't do that, because that's jumping in with 2 feet, not knowing what you're getting into. And sometimes that sounds good. And people who say that, I think, say it well-meaning, but I don't think that the ones who succeed are actually jumping in with 2 feet. I think they've probably done an awful lot that they just don't recognize they've done, that they know that there's an opportunity there. Whereas what I always challenge people to do is do a lot of work outside of your paid work, because a lot of people have commitments. If they have families, or if they have mortgages or rent or whatever else, they do have commitments that they need to pay. And I think putting everything at risk for an idea that you haven't fully researched is dangerous. It's dangerous to you personally. So I think what you should do is research as much as you can in advance. If you are a techie guy or a techie girl, find a commercial person to work with who can do the commercial side for you. And if you're a commercial person, find a techie person who can work with you to get an MVP up and running. So you can get something that is a wireframe, but it works, or it just shows people what it could look like, and then get some market feedback to would they engage if they had a proof of concept or a prototype ready to go. And that you're de-risking it at every stage. And it's, how do you de-risk it to the stage where you say, well, now I see that it's not just one customer. I have a pipeline of customers lined up who are going to jump on board. And now I need to jump in full time. And that's and that point is you only you can decide what that point is. But I've seen far too many people jump in too early and put themselves and their families at risk, and that kind of stuff worries me. If you're young and you have no commitments or whatever else, then fair enough, go for it.
I think that's great advice. And what something you said there is that the ones that are successful and make it, they don't know that they've done so much work. They've just probably had a curiosity, and they probably just built it, didn't even realize it was an MVP, started playing around with it, and then built it out. I think that's the best arc of just do something, though. I think that the key that stops people is to just keep talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. Whereas what you're saying is exactly correct. You don't have to burn the boats. That sexy mythology of like, burn the boats, go all in. But they're going all in on something that's not been proven. They just have maybe a solution to something that's not even a problem. They just have a cool idea. And that's exactly what you said, is build something and show people. Because telling someone is just, it's hard to visualize, isn't it? It's hard to picture.
Yeah, and just getting feedback from potential customers and getting that honest feedback. And I mean, asking your friends and your family and everything else, that's lovely, but yeah, they'll just tell you what you want to hear, right? Asking somebody who doesn't know you, and is, if you're going to be asking for money at some stage, they're immediately skeptical and they'd be cynical as hell. So it's, how do you win them over? And then finding out, are you solving a real problem for them? And are they willing to pay whatever amount of money that you need to charge? There's a huge amount of variables to setting up a company. And even when you got it set up and running, there's a huge amount of variables that happen on a daily basis. And that's part of the fun. It's part of the challenge. And it's part of the, the joy of doing this sector that a lot of people are very passionate about.
So you see so much, right? You see both sides. You see from running your own company and you see all the new companies coming in. So you've had the pipeline for the last 10 years. How have things changed? As in, what are you now seeing coming through that you weren't seeing, say, 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago? What are you now seeing coming through in the Irish scene and kind of on a broader space?
I think it's matured a huge amount. I mean, even in the last 5 years, I think it's matured a huge amount. I think the expectations from the founders of what they now know they need to present to get investment, that bar has been raised hugely from where it was 5 years ago. And on the flip side, from the investor side, the amount of experience that they now have and that they can bring to the table, that's been raised a huge amount as well. And I hope what we do on the H-band side is put the infrastructure and the structure behind that to help both of those sides succeed. So I think there's also a huge amount of extra capital being available. So if you think about the amount of capital that's been available in the market for the last 2 or 3 years, it's been quite phenomenal. Primarily driven out of the US and the UK and SoftBank and other places at the top end are putting in stupid amounts of money into lots of things, which is driving the mid-market guys down further, which drives the lower end guys down, or the earlier stage, I wouldn't say the lower end, the earlier stage guys down to our end.
I get you. Yeah, I didn't realize
that. Is that pressure capital is coming down, which is great. It just means that the companies are getting more money to be able to accelerate either faster or grow bigger. And then when they're going for their second round, so we're seeing an awful lot of follow-on rounds, and they are getting an awful lot more money than they would have got 5 years ago. So whereas 5 years ago they would have got 3 to 5 million, they're now getting 15 to 20 million. I think it's really exciting. I think there's a lot of opportunities there.
You see, how many pitches would you see in a year, roughly?
So in H-band, we get between 600 and 700 inquiries a year. Mm. We bring about 120 to 150 to the network.
And how many would you sit down on then?
Oh, personally? Probably about, I'd say about half of that.
Okay, so you see a massive, massive, massive amount of pitches. Give me some of the key good characteristics of good pitches, because this is another thing that entrepreneurs are unsure about because they get so wedded to their idea and telling you how good it is. What are the key things you see that stand out to you that make you sit up when you're kind of, maybe attention is waning? What are the key things you see that makes a good pitch?
Yeah, there's the tangibles and then there's the intangibles. So the tangibles is that, have you come in with something that's really a compelling value proposition, that you're solving a really interesting problem that's difficult for other people to solve, or that is unique in its own way? And that you have the skill set and the team around you to execute on that. That's kind of that compelling piece. The other bit, which is it's an intangible, is that the energy that the people bring to the pitch. Do you, and I don't mean energy as in you've had 7 Red Bulls. I just mean good, positive energy that's confident but not cocky. you're not being an asshole about stuff. You're just giving it, these are the facts of where we're coming from, where we want to see it. But this is the structure. This is how we're going to do it. And here's the milestones we're going to do it with. And here's the resources that we need to do it. People, whatever, and then cash. And having the ability to be humble about what you do know and what you don't know brings other people on the journey with you. So are you able to bring people on that journey with you? Can they empathize with you? Do they actually like you as a person? Or do they think you're an asshole? If you've got that, you're in a big problem. And I think by and far, most of the people we see are just really good promoters who are very passionate about what they're doing, but they've pulled back the covers a lot to be able to give it that substance, which gives them the credibility. And they're also genuinely decent people. So you see a lot of that, and that's what I love to see.
Less sheen and more substance.
Yeah, so you get a lot of sizzle without the sausage, as they say, right?
Yeah.
So if you can have a bit of sizzle and a bit of sausage, it's good.
There's our second clip. Brilliant. What? How do you do an angel investment, right? If someone's listening to this and they're like, you know what? Last 2 years, business has been okay. I've put a bit of money away. You know, stocks are grand. Crypto's fine. I want to, you know, invest in something else. And maybe they just maybe exited, because you do see a lot of the Irish ecosystem is now getting to a point, which I love, whereby you're now seeing people exit and go, okay, I've sold my business 2, 3, 4, 5 million. Brilliant. Lovely. How do they then get involved to be an angel investor? What's the process?
It's very straightforward. Just ping me or ping somebody in the Ageman network. We'll meet you for coffee. Just find out what your wants are, what you'd like to do. And if you're unsure, we'll just say, listen, just join some of the pitches, see if they're for you. And generally people join one of the syndicates, and they join, and what they see is, so say for example, we do Bloom. They will do every 4 to 6 weeks, they'll do a pitch. They can get up to 60 people on a call, or they might get 20 to 30 people in a room. They will see 4 to 5 companies at every one of those pitches. And when a new person comes along and sits in on those pitches, they see the structure of it is a 10-minute pitch followed by a 10-minute Q&A. But everybody in the room gets to ask questions. So you can see how the entrepreneur responds, how confident are they in terms of their response, or if they don't know the answer, are they happy to say, I don't know the answer to that one for whatever reason, but I'll go and find out and come back to you. And having that confidence to be able to say that, how well do they know the market, how well do they know what their financials are, the technologies and everything else. But then what a new person sees is that if they see 10 other people around the table asking very smart questions about the sectors, that gives them the confidence to say, okay, well, listen, I might put some money in, because there's a deal lead there who is willing to lead and do the due diligence, but they also come from the sector, and therefore I have far more confidence that this is a problem that's been solved, and therefore that's something I might be interested in. And it is as simple as that, and we try to keep the as frictionless as possible, but they engage to understand what the propositions are. And they can also get involved in the due diligence to understand, to lift back the covers properly on the companies, to see what the commercial opportunity really is, to see what the financials are like, the legals are like, the IP is like. And then they can get stuck into doing a term sheet, which is the process of getting investment. And the term sheet just lays out what, from the angel side, we would like to see within the deals, and you agree that before you go to full deals.
Okay, so you've a good support system in there. Even if it's your first time, you still have a good support system of people who've done it, been there, guide you through the process. How do people make money from angel investing?
So ultimately it comes from an exit. They invest X and they get Y back, and that's the blunt force instrument, which is that. And I would say 5 years ago, a lot of companies would have done trade sales, and that exit would have returned the angel's investment plus a multiple of X, Y, or Z. Okay. What we started seeing in the last 5 years is that there's quite a few secondary markets, is what they call them, which is a private equity group or a VC would come in and say, listen, the early stage angels have done their job, which is get it to this early stage, but it still needs to prove itself out. It still needs to scale, but it's done a lot of proving work there. So what we'll do is we'll give these guys, we'll give these angels a 3, 4, 5, 10x of their investment back to say thank you, but we'll buy them out of their shareholding and we'll buy into the company fully. So therefore the angels will make their multiple back. The company stays as is, but it gets fresh capital coming in to help it grow and scale.
Okay, that's a pretty succinct answer.
The other thing we're seeing a lot of now, which is, again, going back to the conference we're having on the 2nd of February, which is the growth of impact investing, is that we're seeing a lot of people coming in saying, the return on my investment as a pure capital, as in cash, is my first preference, or it's one of my preferences. But actually what I want to see is a double or a treble bottom line. So I want to see that there's a societal benefit, or I want to see there's an educational benefit, or there is an environmental benefit. And quite a few people are saying to us now that they want to start focusing in on impact. So they do want to see cash back, but they also want to see one of those impact results.
That's really interesting. It's almost becoming a non-negotiable, I think, really. Whereas before, companies used to talk about, oh, now recyclable, or, oh, you know, now it's just, it is, or it just has to be. There's no kind of, it seems like it's going that way with investing as well. What are the tax reasons then? You hear a lot of stuff in the news, or if you read the Sunday papers, you see now EIIS and now qualify for tax rebates. What sort of tax options are there for people who are investing?
So EIIS, I'd love to say, is still working, or is working great. And the government have made some tweaks, and that's all grateful for that. I still think we can do more. I think we can still make it easier. I think there's still revenue moved from certification to self-certification a couple of years ago, and that's thrown in quite a lot of uncertainty to the companies, to the extent that some of them are saying, we actually don't know, even if we go through the full 4 years, whether you're going to get your EIIS, because we don't know whether revenue are going to certify this or not. And I certainly know a number of companies that have just said, we're not just going to not go there. And I think that uncertainty needs to be lifted. I think government are trying to do it, but somebody just needs to take it by the tail and actually just shake the hell out of it and get it done properly. I think we can do it better. Mm-hmm. So that's my fundamental. It's still not fit for purpose is where I would still be saying, but I think it's moving in the right direction, which is welcome. And I think if you look at it from the perspective of is it meant to be an incentive to help companies grow, or do you look at it from an accounting and auditing perspective, which is how do you stop people from abusing this, which is the way it's currently set up? And they've put so many restrictions in place that nobody can make it work, or they can make it work, but it costs you 10 grand to hire a tax advisor, but you're only raising 100 grand, so yeah, it doesn't make any sense. So I think there's still a long way to go to make it fit for purpose, but I think hopefully we're going in the right direction. And certainly one of the groups that we work with is the Alliance, which is a group of Scale Ireland, the Irish Venture Capital Association, Euronext, a number of others, and ourselves, who are promoting different ways of doing it.
It surely should be incentivized that instead of trying to catch people who are, you know, we're trying to diddle around it, which would be the 1%, maybe factor in for the 99% who are just trying to invest, who want a very clear, this is how you invest, this, put in your 50K at the end of 4 years, if you exit, you're going to get X.
Make it simple.
That always kind of baffled me.
Make the process simple and make it easy for the companies to do it, so that they don't need to hire tax advisors at all different stages. So listen, I think, like I said, we're on a journey. there are definitely some good shifts from the government side, and they've done some good stuff there, but we'd like to see more.
Brilliant. I put out that you're coming on Twitter, and a few people mentioned questions. Luke asked, can you ask John about safe agreements and if Halo will adopt them in the future?
So I mean, ultimately, safe agreements come from the companies. They don't come from ourselves, right? We looked at them back in 2014, 2015, when they started coming out of Y Combinator.
Sorry, what are they, John? I actually need to ask that first.
Well, sorry. Safes are simple agreements for future investment. Mm. Or future equity, and the idea behind a safe is that typically what you do is you invest for equity or you invest through a convertible loan note. They're the two instruments that people would typically use. And what a group in San Francisco called Y Combinator said was they're too complicated and they're too long and legalistic. We're just going to come out with a short document that says, give us X amount of money and we promise to give you some future equity. And it was a simple agreement, as the name would say. Mm. And for small amounts of money, it makes sense because you can get deals done fast. And we've started to see quite a few of those coming through. And I think, listen, for the smaller amounts, it's fine. But the caveat in that is that most of the safe agreements come with side letters. And the side letters typically do the protection side that the other two instruments would have done, which is the equity and the convertible loan note. And you're almost getting to the stage now where the safe is, yes, it's only a 3 or 4 page document, but it's got all these side letters, which actually takes it out to be the same length as the other document. So it's kind of like, oh, okay, well, what are you doing? So I know I've struggled with it, and I know quite a few of our angels have struggled with it. We've done quite a few, and we look at them when they come through. But every angel will look at it through their own risk profile and whether they are willing to do it or not, because there are risks with safes. But there's positives as well in terms of you can get access to capital quickly, which is the whole point of it. So to answer the question, can we adopt them? We don't adopt any of them. We're a market taker on that side of the house, unless we're leading. But the companies, depending what stage they come to us at, may already have a safe in place, and that's fine. We look at those.
I got you. So you're already working with them.
When you look at what's going on in the US, we hear a lot of everybody in the US is using them and everything else. But actually, when you look at the data, there's only 8% in 2021 of all deals in the US were done with safes. And that was primarily done out of California.
Okay.
So there's a lot of Kool-Aid, but I think when you strip it back, there's some good stuff there, and there's some stuff which just needs to wash through yet. Which we are looking at.
Perfect. I have one last question for you. I ask everybody who comes on to recommend a book that's kind of made an impact on them personally, professionally. Can be fiction, nonfiction, sports, business, whatever.
Yeah, no, you did mention this the other day, and I suppose the one I always think back to, it's a book and a movie, and I watch the movie every year. It's Touching the Void.
Okay. Yes.
Which is, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's just one of those. I mean, to me, it's one of those classic stories of the resilience of the human body and mind to get through what Joe Simpson got through. If I bring that back then down to even just the business side, which is when he, not to burst the whole story, but obviously.
Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, stop the interview now, come back in 2 hours.
Big spoiler alert, which is when he does climb out of the crevasse that he's fallen down with a broken leg. When you listen to the movie and you read the book, he talks about how he could see the end of the glacier that he had to get to. And what he did was he did 20 minute sprints to get every sort of couple of feet. And you could sort of just, it just made sense that if he didn't break it down into small chunks of where he needed to get to, he was never going to make it. And that's what he did. But he did that for 3 days till he got to the bottom. I mean, yeah, I mean, the story is obviously a happy ending in the end, but my God, he did some trip to get there.
I love that.
I can almost akin that to what people go through starting a company, which is that, yes, the end goal is there, but you do 20-minute sprints all the way to the end.
I love it.
I don't know if that's a good analogy or not.
It's perfect. I subscribe to that. I'm you've used the word Kool-Aid a lot. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid of the little bursts, the little kind of chunk. How do you eat a whale one bite at a time? I'm very much on that thing because it can be so overwhelming, especially now the world we live in. There's so much going on. There's so much noise and there's so much negativity and there's so much like info to kind of burst through that. You kind of need to bring yourself back. Break it down to the smallest chunks. Why? What can I do today just to even get one step closer? Because no one wants to hear that, right? Everyone wants the sexy, cool story of like, oh, he climbed out, but it was the 20-minute sprints that got him there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and like you said, there's an awful lot of noise out there about everything. And it's difficult to navigate through that noise and ignore the 99% that really isn't relevant to what you're doing in your life. And just at a human level, it's how do you focus on the stuff that's really relevant to you and to your personal group of friends or your family or whatever. And not to forget the important things about that or your community or things you are passionate about doing. And yeah, there's a lot of hype and a lot of bullshit. And it's keeping it real.
Love it. What a way to finish. We didn't even plan that. Beautiful. How can people learn a little bit more about you, about HBAN, and about the conference coming up?
Say that again, sorry?
How can people learn a little bit more about yourself, about HBAN, and then about the conference coming up?
So me, you don't really want to know an awful lot about. You've heard it all there. It's all fairly boring. Around HBAN, it's HBAN.org. Just go to the website there. You'll see access to the conference, which is coming up on the 2nd of February. Got some great speakers coming in. We've got the chair of the ACA in the US, Marcia Daywood. We've got the chair of EBAN, which is the European Business Angel Group, called Jana Jarmelsson. I'm going to say that. She's Finnish. And we've got a husband and wife impact team who set up an impact fund called Tonic. Who have been doing this for the last 20 years. Wow. And just have a great story. And we also have Faye Driard, who from Wake Up Capital, who's doing setting up her own impact fund here as well. So we've got a lot of good speakers. Join us, it's free. And look forward to seeing
excellent. I'll pop it in the show notes. And then just your own company name again, just for anyone who wants to check that out.
RecommenderX.com.
Perfect. John, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Gary, thank you for that. Much appreciated.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with John. I'm back here again on Monday for the Idea Lab. I will see you then. As always, subscribe to the podcast so you get notified when the next episode is live. I'll see you on Monday.